Welcome, everybody, to this debate on globalization in China. On the whole, the LSE hasn't really tried to position itself as a leading player in the field of Chinese studies. But in recent years, we've made a lot of appointments in economics, in economic history, international relations, government, anthropology, and so on, of scholars whose work focuses in some way on China and East Asia. I might also mention that on the student side, the school's applications from students from mainland China have gone up very, very dramatically, increasing by 150% in the past year alone, in 1 year, 150% increase to a total of around 3,500. So now the linkages between the LSE and China are definitely going to grow one way or another, and that's a good thing, we think. Partly working through the school's Asia Research Center, which Chris Hughes is the director of, there are going to be lots of new programs and initiatives in the coming months and years, which I think hopefully will be of interest to those of you who are keen to learn a bit more about China and East Asia. So you should definitely watch this space. Now, before I turn you over to these good people who have actually done some empirical research on globalization in China, which is a notoriously fuzzy kind of topic, and these are people who've actually carried out some concrete research on it, I thought I'd make a few fuzzy introductory remarks. Now, without wishing to talk very much about the blindingly obvious, I suppose that almost everybody here today will be conscious of the coughs and the sneezes of the people who happen to be sitting around them, partly because there are a lot of people from China in the room, and it's possible that you might catch something. Now, this current epidemiological problem which China faces does obviously remind us of a couple of interesting issues in relation to globalization. On the one hand, we know that what we normally call globalization actually encompasses incredibly different kinds of phenomena which really ought to be analyzed at very different levels, whether economic or political or legal or cultural or even in this particular case epidemiological, right, study of disease. On the other hand, we know that these incredibly different levels which require different types of analyses in their own terms sometimes interact very intimately and very rapidly, as the SARS example illustrates. Now, everybody who reads the newspaper will already know the story, but here we have farmers in South China who manage to catch a virus which quickly spreads through a couple of key agents around the world through air travel, affecting the health of people in Taiwan and Toronto and even a few in the UK. That's bad news for the world and a bad effect of globalization. However, new information flows mean that the world's medical expertise can quickly or virtually instantly be brought to bear on this problem. So surely this is good news for China. However, for the Chinese government, this epidemic is a potential problem, perhaps especially because of its potential impact on the economy. Therefore, it's very political, it's not just a health issue, and a kind of cover-up is attempted by some officials somewhere. However, the global media and the internet make that kind of cover-up virtually impossible, and in very short order, a domestic, epidemiological, economic, and political issue becomes an international one. That, in turn, is bad news, again, for China, not to mention bad news for Taiwan, which, in a very interesting twist on all of this story, cannot get very much help from the World Health Organization because, thanks to China, Taiwan is not considered a state. Now, as even this incredibly superficial overview makes plain, here the epidemiological quickly becomes the political becomes the economic, and so on. Now, this sort of tension between the separable aspects of globalization and the fact that these things get conflated in the real world in any particular case creates a methodological challenge for people who really want to study globalization. That is, we probably ought to focus on very narrowly defined problems which can be researched in a rigorous and empirical way, and yet we somehow always have to keep an eye on a much bigger picture. For instance, the two anthropologists on our panel today partly know what they know about China because they've spent many years conducting sometimes grindingly long-term ethnographic research among very small samples of people, and often in the countryside. This gives them a good kind of understanding of how things really play out on the ground, and they can focus on something highly specific. For example, how people in a Chinese village in Heilongjiang at a particular moment in time talk about Western notions of individualism, and this example we'll come back to in a minute. At the same time, they're keenly aware of the need to consider a topic like that holistically, for example, to see how cultural ideas, for example, notions of individualism, can affect the economic behavior of people, or conversely, how economic change can lead to wholesale cultural transformation. Sometimes, even for these microethnographers, it's important to step back far away from the villages and city streets and ask much more general and far-reaching questions about the overall pattern of China's involvement with the world. To a great extent, that kind of stepping back is the point of today's panel. Now, in 1 second, I'm going to hand it over to our experts, James Watson, Chris Hughes, Yan Yunxiang, and Kent Dung, and ask them to talk briefly about their own research. As they start, there are several key themes related to China's particular experience of globalization, which I think you might want to perhaps hold in the back of your mind. Think of these as key terms. The first is history, of course. Although we often say that China's been very slow to open to the West, the fact is that China's been involved in regional and global flows of ideas and goods for centuries. This global engagement didn't start when Deng Xiaoping opened the door. The second key word is regionalism. The story of China's relation with the world is certainly not a simple one of a west-to-east kind of influence. Bear in mind, for instance, China's profound cultural impact centuries ago on what is now Japan, Vietnam, and Korea, or, to cite a very different and more recent example, bear in mind Japan's profound influence on the history of the Chinese and Taiwanese entry into the modern age. The third key word to bear in mind is scale. When we talk about the potential impact of global forces on China, it's very different from the discussion about the impact of global forces on, say, Amazonian forest people. China obviously has an enormous population, a deeply entrenched cultural tradition with a very long history, and now an increasingly powerful economy. Nobody seriously thinks that China, as we know it, is simply going to vanish under a Western onslaught. But the question of whether or not globalization is a good thing for the Chinese people as an engine for wealth creation, as a driver of political liberalization, or even as a process which partly legitimizes continuing Communist Party rule is very much open to debate. Anyway, now I'm going to move over to the other place. And we can have some discussion. Can you still hear me? That's all right. Good. First of all, I'd like to introduce Professor James L. Watson, who has an incredibly posh sounding job. He is the John King and Wilma Cannon Fairbank Professor of Chinese Society at Harvard University, and well deserved. James Watson has published very widely over a period of many years on a wide range of topics, including globalization, multinationals, the impact of multinational companies in the world today, and before that, he published a lot on Chinese kinship and religion. He's the editor of a book which was a real blockbuster, I suppose, called Golden Arches East, McDonald's in East Asia. And we've asked James to talk to us first. If you prefer, as you wish. You prefer there, yeah? Okay.
Yes, can you hear? This is okay. Well, it's very nice to be here. Let me first of all thank our panel organizer, Charles Stafford, and also the department here at the LSE. I should say one of the things that Charles did not mention is that in an earlier incarnation, I was a lecturer in Asian anthropology down the street at SOAS for 11 years from 1972 to 1983. So in a sense, it's always very nice to come back to London and to see how things have changed. So I always tell my students at Harvard that I really have two field sites. One is China and the other is Britain, treating this as the other. And in some respects, you can see that very much just by walking around London, as I've done in the last couple of days. One of the points of my research that I've been doing for the last, now it's been over a decade, is to track McDonald's and to look at how McDonald's has either changed itself or how it's changed institutions around the world. And I chose East Asia because that's where I've done most of my research. But yesterday in walking through Waterloo Station, I asked myself, now what would a Swedish or a Chinese anthropologist come to, what kind of conclusion would they come to by walking through Waterloo Station? Now, I spent many days in the 1970s at Waterloo Station trying to catch my train to Teddington, which was always canceled. but I do recall that you couldn't really get a decent sandwich except an old British Rail sandwich, if some of you remember what that was like. But if you were to go to Waterloo Station today, you would find a place that sells American-style bagels, which are quite good. You find Starbucks, McDonald's, Burger King, and a series of other very interesting entrepreneurial institutions, including a new one that's called Rocket, which my wife, Ruby, is interested in investigating as well. She's interested in the history of prepared foods and how it's transformed family life. Something dramatic has happened here in England in the last decade in terms of the food system. But could one come to the conclusion by looking at Waterloo Station that British society is being Americanized? Are you more American than you were 10, 20 years ago? Is that the consequence of globalization? What this leads me to conclude is that globalization is in the eyes of the beholder. And many of us make the mistake when we visit other societies and we see the effects, the form of globalization, namely McDonald's on every corner. I just came from Halle and the old East Germany. There's McDonald's everywhere. Does one assume that the form also rebounds and reflects on the content of the cultural system? Many of the theorists of globalization that I've reviewed in the last few years in my writing and in my teaching have made a fundamental error, in my view, of confusing form with content. By confusing what they see and automatically assume is a direct consequence of the globalization of systems. Just because people eat at McDonald's, drink Coca-Cola, wear knockoffs of Nike shoes, and blue jeans does not make them American. We understand that implicitly. But at some point, we make the shift, and we then begin to see these institutions as being infinitely more powerful than they really are. And my conclusion of the research that I've done in China and elsewhere is that all of us, as intellectuals, suffer from a kind of myopia. We give corporations far too much cultural credit for transformations in the societies than they actually deserve. What I want to do here today, in kind of the trick of debates, is to turn Charles Stafford's question around and repose it back. He's asking us, is globalization good for China? I would say that, well, perhaps good or bad, but another way of phrasing that question is, was globalization good for China? Because clearly it's reached the point of no return, and the process of globalization, as one of my colleagues will be explaining earlier, has been going on for centuries. Or another way is to look at this debate from the perspective of another really hot issue, hot debate, that preoccupied American China scholars of my generation. During the 1980s and 1990s, basically the debate then was socialism good for China? Now, like our current debate today, globalization, socialism, opinions vary very much according to one's political stance. And having worked on McDonald's in China and Hong Kong and elsewhere over the last decade, I'm now shifting my research to looking at the responses to McDonald's as a kind of ideological frame. I'm trying to actually investigate how intellectuals around the world in various societies have reacted to McDonald's. But that's a substantive research that perhaps I should save for another time in another place, because often it makes intellectuals very uncomfortable when we investigate ourselves. Responses to globalization, as we know, all of us in this room, are heavily freighted with the politics of the personal. Often it's a reflection of our own attitudes towards the world. It's obvious that China has been profoundly affected and profoundly changed by the multiple forces of globalization. There has been the good, the bad, and the downright ugly. And I think we will hear about all of these today. Ugly and good and bad consequences of globalization. It's essentially the old metaphor of the blind men grasping hold of the elephant and describing it however, whichever end one happens to grip hold of. Now, so I take it as my task today to focus briefly on what I see as the unmitigated good influence of globalization in China. Just for the sake of argument and to irritate Charles Stafford, I will argue that, as an opening, that in one important respect, globalization has been profoundly good for China. And that has to do with the opening, the literal opening up of Chinese society in the last 20 years. Now, calling on my own personal experience of China, for having worked in and around China for over three decades, I take a rather more historical perspective of this. And for the vast majority of ordinary Chinese people, I'm going to be arguing, especially the vast majority of urbanites in China, their society is more open today, I would claim, and offers more possibilities for social mobility for the ordinary person than at any time since the heyday of the Ming Dynasty in the 15th century. I don't think things have ever been so good for the ordinary Chinese person. I'm looking back to what it was like during the Great Leap Forward period, during the early years of Maoism, and that century-long civil war that led to the current situation. The Chinese people from China, from mainland China, not just emigres, and not just the Huachao, overseas Chinese Chinese that one dealt with mostly in the 50s, but people from Shanghai, Beijing, Guangzhou, Fudan, and various other sorts of places in China, now are found everywhere. And this, to me, is the most remarkable experience of globalization that one can possibly see. Chinese people are traveling everywhere. The Chinese cultural influences are found everywhere. Even in East Germany, one can find the influences, the old East Germany. But increasingly, Chinese people are more and more influential in the world. PRC citizens are today playing leading roles in every type of global arena. You only have to visit the labs of MIT and USC to see the profound effect that young Chinese people are having on world sciences. And you can cut right through societies, not just in the United States, but here in Britain as well. Look around the room. Who's sitting next to you? Who are two of the people on this panel? Both of whom are from Beijing. Very, very interesting to me with my long-term view of these things. PRC citizens are playing those leading roles. In every field from sports, you all know, of course, about Yao Ming, the basketball player. I guess you do. I presume basketball is followed here by some. And then, of course, from sports to social anthropology, we find the influence of the opening of China. The intangible aspects of this openness are perhaps, in my view, even more important than the quantifiable econometric measures that people often use to understand globalization, the intangibleness of the opening. China today is a normal place. It's an ordinary country that anyone can visit and get around and can know firsthand from first experience. This is a profound change from what it was like no more than perhaps even a decade ago. An entire generation of my Harvard students have wandered up and down, back and forth, here and there in China with their backpacks and with remarkably fluent Chinese language skills for young Americans. It's an ordinary place. American kids are learning Chinese as my generation learned German and French and Spanish. It's no big deal to speak Chinese today. I can tell you how I learned Chinese in the 1960s, between the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Vietnam War. It's not a happy story. And I would not be here today, standing here as a living person, had it not been for the fact that Chairman Mao Zedong did not cross the North Vietnamese border, or I certainly would not be here. That's how I learned Chinese. So there are tremendous differences in the openness today. I cannot tell you how astonishing it is to me, as a China scholar of my generation, a child of the Cold War, to witness this profound and what I can say is very dramatic transition. Like, as I said, I learned Chinese, and most of my generation learned it as a, quote, critical language, which, of course, was code for enemy language. But those were the dark days, and you could probably count the American speakers of Chinese on two or three hands in the early 1960s when I began. Now, China these days, and in the 1960s and the Cold War period, was not only closed to the world, but Chairman Mao had elevated detachment from the world system to a high art form. Today, the fact that hundreds of thousands, now approaching millions, of non-Chinese people, many of whom are in the room, can know China and know Chinese people is, to my mind, can know it intimately, is an unmitigated good. And today, the fact that there are hundreds of thousands of well-placed Chinese citizens who know the world beyond China and is also, in my view, an unmitigated good, a consequence of globalization, the boomerang effect, or what might be called the splashback effect of globalization. Now, I can say this even so that there's also the negative effect of experience of the West, what might be called the Al-Qaeda effect. And you can find this in American education. Many of the most vociferous anti-Americans, of course, were trained at the Harvard, the John Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and are now around the world. So this does often have a rebound effect, which leads to a form of Chinese neo-nationalism in response to their personally bad experiences in the West. So it can work in various ways. And I think one of our panelists will talk about nationalism. Now, in my opening, I mentioned the good, the bad, and the downright ugly consequences of globalization in China. Like everyone on this panel, I'm deeply concerned about the bad, the growing gap between the rich and the poor, and all of us see it everywhere in China. Parallel to this is the growing regional difference between coastal China and the interior China. This is an old story, and this is precisely why Mao Zedong and his colleagues launched the Chinese Civil War and established the Chinese People's Republic in 1949, to turn the world upside down, both in terms of class and in terms of region. Well, we're back, and hence the debate that I referred to earlier about was socialism good for China? Now, but returning to the question of globalization, and perhaps most worrying of all, is the ugly consequences. And this is a reemergence of a culturally essentialist form of nationalism, a reactive, defensive ideology wrapped up in postmodern packages that one can find in places like Shanghai and especially in Beijing among the intelligentsia, many of whom spent years at American graduate schools and have come back to react in this way. And this ideology is now being promoted by what is patently, obviously, we saw from what Charles was describing earlier about the response to SARS, it's being developed by an insecure political elite grasping at straws because, of course, socialist ideology is dead and they need something in its place. So what better to do than ride the tiger of nationalism? But as we all know from Chinese folklore, when you ride the tiger of nationalism, watch out, because it will bite badly. So that responding here to the Chinese intellectuals are obviously responding to the threat, as they see it, from Washington, D.C. Recently, which has been recently transformed, as you all know, by another form of kind of postmodern nationalism, promoted by a new elite of American neoliberals. And the two are, I see, completely as a world system, the consequences of this global patterns that we've been many people are describing. So all of these are worrying developments, and there are storm clouds on the horizon. But this does not change my bottom line view of my personal history of looking at globalization. Is the question then, is globalization good for China? I would say yes, a firm vote of confidence for the future of China. And I remain resolutely optimistic that China will be a better place for the ordinary person, for all Chinese, in 20 years. Thank you.
As Woody knows, it's my job to ask him a kind of mean question, because we like to, you know, greet visitors with warm welcome and contempt, equal measures. So, I mean, I really want to actually ask you about methodology, to go back to that, because obviously in your presentation for this debate, you've talked about a whole range of very general topics, and yet your own research focuses on some extremely narrow and focused topics which are approached through empirical research or the research of people who are working with you and so on. And I wonder how you actually manage to connect the two things, that is the close, careful empirical research on the one hand and the kind of general statements you're making in this kind of debate. Mm-hmm. My guess is that you don't connect them at all. My guess is that you could provide us with a lot of evidence which would convince us about, say, how McDonald's really is experienced by real Chinese people in Beijing today. We would believe that, and your arguments about multinationals and so on, we would believe that. But what you would find very difficult would be to convince us of your arguments, for example, about why American nationalism is somehow a better thing than Chinese nationalism, if you like, which I took to be an element in your argument. So really the question is, what's the connection between the kind of micro research that you do and the claims you're making in this debate about, you know, the face of China today?
Okay. Sorry, could you hear it this way? I hope I was not implying somehow valuing one form of nationalism over another, especially the version that is now currently the rage in my society. I wouldn't want that impression. But the issue of empirical research is a very critical one, because the point that anthropologists can separate themselves, I would say, often from other disciplines and other forms of study, is the engagement with known communities and with people who, for instance, in the McDonald's study, one can restrict the research to a certain universe of people who are experiencing McDonald's, and you can come to conclusions. What I would propose is that I think the same kind of methodology could be used for the study of nationalism. And I think it has been by some sociologists and some anthropologists. My own experience of it would be to look at to do empirical research on the attitudes of returning Liomei, of Chinese students who are returning from China, from the United States to China, and working there and taking jobs, and seeing what the consequences of their experience, in this case in the United States, perhaps you could also do it for London, what that experience has had in terms of their attitudes towards globalism and their attitudes towards a kind of essentialist Chinese nationalism. So I think the methodological approach could be used in both. The difficulty, of course, is that every time anthropologists try to study the intelligentsia or other elites, it becomes infinitely more difficult because, of course, the question of time. I've encountered this in my own research on a Chinese diaspora that I've been tracking for over 30 years. As they become more successful and become more wealthy, time is money. And they don't have time to sit around in the tea house all afternoon or all morning with me talking about what life is like and what the end result of it is. So I would suspect that doing empirical research on the Chinese intelligentsia today in Beijing would be a very difficult thing to do, but it certainly is doable.
Okay. We're going to leave it there. The plan for this is that everyone gets to say their bit. I'm going to ask a quick question, and then we'll move on so that everyone has time, and then later on we'll open it up for discussion. The next presenter is Yan Yunxiang, who is an associate professor of anthropology at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles. Yunxiang is a very interesting guy, I can say. partly, just briefly to say, because I think it is very interesting, because he was born in Beijing, and not too long before the start of the Cultural Revolution and so on, and when he was 12, he had to go with his family and live in the countryside, as of course many people of bad class background, Chushan Buhao, had to do in the 60s. So he had 5 years of education, and remarkably, at the end of the Cultural Revolution, after Mao died and so on, Yunxiang managed to pass the examinations and get back to Beijing and back to Beijing University, where he studied literature and folklore, before again, remarkably, getting into Harvard, where he did a PhD in anthropology. So, Fu Jiandan is not a simple person. Anyway, sorry, that's a personal footnote. Yunxiang's research topics include economic anthropology, social change and development, and Chinese kinship. He's written a lot about reciprocity and gift exchange, which is incredibly important thing in the Chinese countryside in economic terms. But his most recent book, just published this year by Stanford, is called Private Life Under Socialism, Love, Intimacy, and Family Change in a Chinese Village, 1949 to 1999. Yan Yunxiang.
I'd like to thank Charles and all of Yale for giving me this opportunity to share some of my thoughts. And if I had the chance, I would say the same back to Charles. Charles, you are an interesting individual too. I know something about you.
Spare us.
And, Professor James Watson was my thesis supervisor, and is still my mentor in many aspects. And one of the things I learned from him, actually one of the things he taught all of us, with a student of him, is to think, always try our best to think independently and creatively. So since he has been talking about the goodness, the good part of globalization for China, that leaves me no choice but to talk about the bad aspect, the negative aspect of globalization for China. And basically I'm going to talk about the flipping image of individualism in the Chinese discourse and during the past century, and their implications, in particularly the implications for our understanding of the flow of information. Because in current studies of globalization, it has been a commonplace to emphasize the flows of information, image, capital, and people. And many theoreticians believe that these flows have led to the deterritorialization of cultures. What I want to reflect today is whether the deterritorializing effect of those flows might have been exaggerated. Taking the image of individualism in Chinese discourse, I wonder if the increased flow of information has indeed changed or improved this kind of understanding of Western individualism in China, or as in many other cases of a cross-cultural consumption, such as in the case of McDonald's, it has turned out to be a uniquely Chinese understanding of individualism. Let me start with two examples. The first is a rather generic story about how individualism is practiced in Western societies. It goes like this. When children reach the age of 18 or above, and if they still live with their parents will charge them for rent. And when the parents, on the other side, when the parents grow too old and therefore they have to live with their adult children, the reverse is also true. The children will charge their parents rent. So this is a generic story in different versions being talked again and again in discourse, Chinese discourse of individualism. Probably from the 1920s all the way up to the 1970s, this rent story has been used to demonstrate the dark side of Western individualism. That is, driven by greed, people have become so selfish that they capture the opportunity to exploit their family members. However, since the 1980s and up to now, the rent story was reinterpreted to be the perfect example of entrepreneurialism and market competition. People do this because they have to do this according to market rules. And it is the human nature to pursue self-interest at the expense of emotional attachment among family members. The second story draws my fieldwork in a North China village. Mr. Wang's daughter broke her engagement because she thought her fiancé was too much a Lao Shi type of person. Lao Shi in Chinese means too nice, and it means nice and naive. So despite of the fact that her fiancé and his family had treated her quite well, and she still wanted to break the engagement because she thought he was too much Lao Shi. When Mr. Wang, the father, was asked how he would think of the feeling of that young man who was dumped simply because he was too nice, Ms. Wang said he was sorry for the poor guy, but still fully supported his daughter's decision. In his own words, quote, "Today's society is a world of wolves. People have to fight with one another like hungry wolves. Every wolf is selfish and ruthless, with no feelings and no mercy. A Lao Shi type of a boy is like a sheep that cannot fight against even the weakest wolf. I don't feel comfortable to let my daughter marry a sheep. Both of them will be eaten up by the wolves." A central message shared by these two stories is that in a modern society, people are governed by a kind of individualism that is extremely selfish, cruel, and hostile, so that one has no choice but to join the fight of wolves. And this message is confirmed by a brief review of the Chinese discourse of individualism ever since the turn of last century. The Chinese term for individualism is a 个人主义. Like many other terms, this one was invented by the Japanese intellectuals when they translated Western theories during the Meiji period. And the term was then introduced into China as one of the new concepts that can be held for great promise to solve the largest problem back then, that is national salvation. I certainly cannot do justice to summarize the entire discourse in a few sentences, but I still hope that the following brief account can give us some clue about what is missing from the discourse. Since 1900 up to 1911's revolution, individualism had a negative connotation in the discourse, in the writings of among those leading intellectuals such as Liang Qichao and many others. For instance, Liang Qichao argues that the nation state should take absolute precedence over the individual. And the liberty of a people is much, much more important than the individual freedom. Up to 1920, such a treatment of individualism began to change during the second decade, when a number of intellectuals placed the modern individualism in an opposite position to the state collectivity. For those intellectuals in the second decade of 1900, the most important thing is the self-realization of the individual. The state, society, community, and family should all work to provide social conditions for the development of the individual. This new and positive image of individualism directly resulted to the new cultural movement, which occurred in 1917, in which the liberation of the self and the humanistic literature became the central issues. However, it is also during the new cultural movement, traditional Chinese culture became public enemy number one, as Confucianism, the Chinese family, and the patriarchal order were regarded as the chief oppressors of the individual. The tide changed much quicker than people could imagine. Starting from 1921, the leftist series began to criticize individualism as a negative, passive, and a destructive value to the society. In 1922, Chen Duxiu, one of the most famous advocates of individualism during the New Cultural Movement in 1917, made a 100-degree turn, denouncing individualism as a socially irresponsible idea. In another very influential article published in the same year, the author labeled individualism as a corrupt bourgeois ideology focusing on the pursuit of self-interest only. And therefore, the author suggests individualism should be replaced by the values of socialism. The Chinese Communist Party was founded in 1921, and Chen Duxiu was the first secretary in general. So it is rather natural for the party to regard Western individualism as the ideological enemy of state socialism. After repeated propaganda and political campaigns sponsored by the party from the 1920s all the way up to the 1970s, individualism was thoroughly, thoroughly demonized as a corrupt, irresponsible, and antisocial value of the dying capitalist culture, which is characterized by selfishness, lack of concern for others, aversion to group discipline, and runaway hedonism. This evil image of individualism was suddenly turned on its head during the post-Mao reform era of the early 1980s, because it was rediscovered to be one of the engines of modernization in the West, stimulating individual incentives and economic growth. Yet, there has been no serious effort to explore what individualism actually is and how it works out in Western societies. Therefore, the previous understanding of individualism remains the same in today's China. Individualism is still a selfish, utilitarian, and hedonistic morality. The only thing changed is that the previous denouncement and critique are now replaced by outright praise and admiration. Is this Chinese understanding of individualism the same as that in the West? Apparently not. Modern individualism in the West developed from a combination of different sources and historical movements, and therefore can be defined in a number of different ways. While political and religious individualism tended to focus on social contract, liberty, fairness, freedom, and self-improvement, economic individualism emphasizes on utilitarian pursuit, competition, self-interest, and hedonism. Yet, independence and self-reliance seem to be the two most common and basic elements in almost all definitions of individualism, regardless of its utilitarian or liberal orientation. From a functional perspective, Western individualism can be seen as having two sides. One is the liberating side that features the primacy of the self and individual rights. And another is the constraining side that recognizes the importance of other individuals' rights. In other words, individualism is not only about the self. It also deals with the relationship between the self and others. It is through this emphasis on the relationship between the self and others, individualism defines an individual's place in a society, or addressing the relationship between individual and society in almost the same kind of function as collectivism does. The Chinese discourse of Western individualism missed two important parts, in my opinion. First, it focuses on the liberating side of individualism, such as the primacy of the self and individual rights, while missing the constraining side, such as the respect of other individuals' equal rights. Second, it effectively turned individualism as a morality of the self only, while missing the important part that Western individualism also addresses the relationship between the self and other individuals. As a result, individualism in China became synonymous of egotism, and in most of the time, synonymous of evil. It is no wonder why, except for a short period of time during the 1920s, the image of individualism has long been negative until the 1980s, which made its recent reversal even more worrisome, because it could lead to the moral justification of social disintegration and many other things. In conclusion, there are culturally rooted reasons why individualism was understood only as egotism in China, and there are also additional political reasons why it was first denounced from the 1920s to the 70s by the party, and then praised afterwards, which, however, cannot be discussed here. The only point I want to make is that current Chinese understanding of Western individualism remains the same as that during the turn of last century, which suggests that the increased flow of information in the globalization age has not been helpful at all in tearing down the cultural boundaries that prevented a better understanding of Western individualism in the first place. Moreover, the flow of information has been commercialized more than ever before, and thus governed by the rule of demand and supply in the market. The influx of information, such as imported books, arts, movies, pop songs, and TV series, only reinforced the extremely utilitarian form of egotism, because only those cultural products that can be sold entered the Chinese market. Hence, the reproduction of the Chinese version of individualism. Thank you.
Yun Xiang, thank you very much. I might just mention that if you want to join us tomorrow night at 5:30 in the same lecture theater, Yun Xiang is going to be giving a lecture tomorrow night, which will show a very concrete case in which this misunderstanding of the Western concept of individualism leads to very concrete effects in the Chinese village where he's carried out fielding. In a nutshell, you've got young people partly drawing on this misconceived individualism, ratcheting up the cost of marriage, increasing the cost of marriage and using, if you like, the proceeds for their own ends. It's a very interesting story, but anyway, much too detailed to get into right now. So just one quick question, and again, it's a methodological one.
And my question is, I like the story that you tell us about individualism, and I like the story you tell us about how globalization hasn't kind of sorted out, you know, the kind of Chinese misunderstanding in this case. But where is this concept of individualism actually located? Because the evidence that you've given us, on the one hand, you've got your vignettes from the village, and that's a kind of evidence. You know, these are people in the village who say these kinds of things, like the world is made of wolves and so on and so on. But then you're jumping back and forth between that kind of evidence and the kind of evidence that is there, for example, in the philosophers back in the 20s, the party officials and so on. I mean, that's very different types of material. Can it really be brought together in a coherent argument? Or are you over-systematizing this data?
Well, a short answer is I did it deliberately so that you can ask me a question.
Right.
A longer answer, actually, is that this was originally a footnote, a long footnote, about how Chinese understanding of individualism is. Mm. So, as you already said, it will be in the context of ethnographic study where you can see the real evidences.
Right. Okay. That's it. We'll take that answer. Come to the lecture is the answer. Right. Now, quickly moving on. Dr. Chris Hughes, as I've already said, is the director of the LSE's Asia Research Center, and he's also a reader in the Department of International Relations, which is one of the, as many of you will know, one of the LSE's very, very strong departments, and his research has focused, among other things, on the relationship between globalization and nationalism, really important topic. His publications include the books Taiwan and Chinese Nationalism and Nationalism and Globalization, Squaring the Circle in Chinese International Relations. Chris.
Okay, thanks, Charles. I'm going to sit down for this, so I take it this is working, because I'm going to use the projector. Excuse me if my voice is a bit rusty and I punctuate this with some coughs, but I've had this for about 3 weeks and I've taken my temperature. No? Can't hear.
Can everyone hear it top?
Yeah.
Is that all right? Yeah.
I take my temperature regularly, so it's just a normal English cold, which do still exist. But Charles asked me posed the question, is globalization good for Chinese nationalism? And I think this is a lovely question because it does question the sort of common assumption that somehow globalization undermines nationalism, and it does open the possibility that actually globalization can make nationalism stronger. So the question is about the relationship between these two, I would call them discourses for now, and I will focus in the first part of this on intellectual discourse, elite discourse, if you like, looking at the relationship between the discourse on globalization and that on nationalism. Now, to do this, I did a simple experiment, which, thanks to our access to the China National Knowledge Infrastructure Database, which is a database of thousands of Chinese academic and industry journals, and which you all have access to on campus, by the way, and please do use it, and then the library might carry on paying a subscription. But you can do this yourself. I put in these two terms, nationalism and globalization, and conducted a search of all the journals on this database, which is nearly all of them, since 1994. And on this side, you can see I correlated it with some of the key events and to see what the pattern is. And it's quite staggering, you can see from a first glance. But just to go over it very briefly, you can see that the number of articles in these Chinese journals looking at nationalism and globalization started off at about the same level in 1994. And if we look at the nationalism column first, we've seen a steady increase, a steady rise in the number of nationalism articles. They're not necessarily advocating nationalism. Some of them are critical of nationalism, but they are talking about it as their main issue. And nationalism is not just in the title, it's in the text. But the figure goes from 35 up to 101. And we can see That this correlates with events like the Taiwan crisis in 95, 96, where we see a slight surge in the number and then it drops off a bit around 97 and the 15th Party Congress. Then it picks up quite strongly after the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade and has carried on ever since with the coming to power of the Bush administration, the spy plane incident and so on. So there has been a sort of incremental increase. But look at the column on globalization. And wow, you know, there's an explosion of articles there from 34 right up to, you know, 5,131 last year. So this poses an interesting question. Does this mean that in some way globalization is displacing nationalism and that the sort of discourse on globalization has pushed out nationalism in some way? I would question that assumption, and I think this probably goes back to one of the things Professor Watson said earlier, that, you know, anyone who goes to China or reads Chinese texts a lot, or even people who look at their TVs around about the time of the Belgrade incident, you'll see that nationalism is still very strong. It's still a very popular movement. So I would suggest that what we see here instead is a process of globalization actually appropriating nationalism, that much of what is said about globalization has actually taken up the themes of nationalism. And I'd like to say a bit about how that's happened. It's very interesting if we start off by looking at the year 1997, where really you start to see the number of articles on nationalism taking a big jump. And of course, that is the year of the 15th Party Congress. That's important because this was the first time that Jiang Zemin, General Secretary of the Communist Party, used the term globalization in a work report to the Communist Party National Congress. Now that's important because it sort of legitimized and told everyone, okay, go ahead, talk about globalization. This is central to Communist Party policy and therefore state and government policy for the future. And it has grown in importance in the official policy discourse since then. Now, this is an interesting formula because, of course, it goes against the sort of common sense understanding in other parts of the world that this Communist Party system should be doing anything but encouraging globalization. But here they are, putting it in a work report, triggering off a huge explosion of articles about globalization. Well, what did Jiang Zemin really do at the 15th Party Congress? In effect, he was doing something very old-fashioned. He was going back to the 19th century. This formula of Ti Yong that Confucian reformers promoted in the 19th century, that you can somehow preserve the Chinese national essence, the Ti, by absorbing functional technology, the Yong of Western technology. And there's that sort of assumption, if we do take the longer historical view of nationalism, this has been a central element of it right from the late 19th century up to the present and has sort of been revived in effect by Jiang Zemin. And it comes to a head, I suppose, in his latest contribution to the party line and the official ideology known as the Three Representations ideology. Well, the Three Representations is very interesting. It's thoroughly globalized. It's a globalist ideology in a sense. The first of the represents is that the Communist Party should represent the advanced forces of production, by which they mean the sort of elite of entrepreneurs and people working in the high-tech sector, the sort of high-tech whiz kids. These are the people that the Communist Party should represent first of all, and they're the ones who will work with the Communist Party to build up a strong Chinese nation-state. So in that sense, you can see that the appropriation of nationalism by globalization is quite clear in the party line itself. And that has, of course, an impact on what people can say. So is that good for nationalism? Well, as I've already said, it's certainly good for nationalism in the sense of the party ideology, where the party presents itself as the savior of the Chinese nation, and that the party is the only organization that can harness the forces of globalization in a world of wolves, I suppose, a world of intense competition. So the party is needed more than ever. But also, if we look beyond the party itself to this increasing amount of commercial literature that's being produced by various think tanks and so on, there are also those nationalist intellectuals that Professor Watson mentioned in his talk, the chauvinists, if you like, who also are able to use globalization as a discourse to appropriate it. A good example is the writer Wang Xiaodong, who wrote a book called China Under the Shadow of Globalization. And he is a self-proclaimed nationalist. He's very proud of it. He says, I am a nationalist. And his book is all about globalization, what a threat it is to China, and therefore that's why we need more nationalism. But what, in a sense, if you look closer at the Chinese political scene, what Wang is doing is using globalization to discredit some far more liberal figures in the political scene who have been saying that nationalism is actually dangerous for China. And he's saying, well, you know, if you think, if you sort of pro-Western liberalizing intellectuals think that nationalism is dangerous, then what are we going to have to protect us in a world of globalization? So there's a sort of political strategy there as well. Equally, if we look at various bureaucratic actors in the system, whether it be the military, perhaps, or other bureaucratic actors like the Ministry of Information Industries, these have a vested interest in appropriating globalization for the sake of and justify using it to justify essentially nationalistic tasks, which then allow them to accrue greater budgets. People's Liberation Army and the Ministry of Information Industries have been amongst the foremost advocates of things like information warfare, the need to face off the threat of that organization by giving them more money to build up their expertise and their capabilities in these areas. And when you look closely at what information warfare is, it's still highly suspect whether, you know, there's much of a threat anyway, but that's another issue. But they are convinced there is, and it's very useful for accruing budgets. So certainly amongst elites and amongst certain policy makers and bureaucratic actors, they are pro-nationalist, and they can use globalization to justify a stronger nationalism. I'd like to descend a bit from the intellectual discourse to policy making very briefly and ask, well, what does that all mean in reality, all that rhetoric, all that discourse stuff? And I suppose, you know, I'd just like to briefly touch on two case studies. One is information technology, and the other is health, which has already been mentioned, because these are the sort of two cutting areas now of the globalization, the cutting edge sort of factors of the globalization debate. Obviously, information technology is seen by many as the driving force, one of the driving forces of globalization, and now health issues, epidemics, also seen as a very negative side of globalization. So in terms of these two policy areas, and really we need to look at more, but start off with two, the information technology, if you look at the policy, it's actually allowed policymakers to succeed. The idea of an information revolution has allowed them to really manipulate or appropriate the globalization discourse for nationalistic purposes. And we see this evidence of this in three reports that have come out recently, one by Rand, one by Carnegie, and one by the Asia Research Center here, which came out 4 weeks ago, published by Routledge, available in the Economist bookshop. But all of these conclude, really, that there has been a great deal of success by the Chinese state in appropriating information technology for various purposes, whether it's economic development or administration and so on. But at the same time, understanding the technology in a sophisticated enough way to ensure that some sort of control is maintained over its usage and it does not spill over into political change. So that's something we may wish to come back to. And then if we move on to health very briefly, and here I suppose, and I must premise this by saying I'm sure our hearts go out to these poor people who are suffering right now in these hospitals and various places in China and Taiwan, and the stories of heroism which don't seem to appear in the press here, but which are in all the Chinese newspapers, is truly very moving. And we have to ask here whether this is very bad for Chinese nationalism. I think it has to be bad for Chinese nationalism, what is happening now. In a sense, this kind of this spread of epidemics, whether it's HIV, AIDS, or SARS, it kind of reveals a lot of the hollow rhetoric of this talk about harnessing the forces of globalization to build up a strong, efficient state. I mean, it hasn't happened here. Instead of the great information technology system that so much money has been invested in, instead of it being used for an efficient information gathering system that's allowing people to know what's going on and then disseminating it to tell them what to do, obviously this didn't happen, despite all the talk about e-governance and so on. Instead, we see a sort of return to what appear to be sort of more or less medieval methods of disease control, of quarantine. The word itself, I learned recently, comes from the Italian word for 40 days, which is how long people used to be kept out of Italian cities when there were plagues around. In the Middle Ages, this is a medieval sort of way of dealing with it, so that all this talk about globalization has not really helped. And on the other hand, within the system of global governance, we see this anomaly of Taiwan, which has also been mentioned, not being a part of the system of global governance because it's not part of the World Health Organization. Now that, of course, is a real threat to Chinese nationalism, because already there is a political campaign about this, which is growing quite strong. And this, of course, poses a direct threat to the government's policy in China. And so in that sense, you know, globalization is a threat to the nationalist discourse, as is, I suppose, opening up the country to foreign inspectors. So I just wanted to draw attention to those two sort of case studies that draw attention in one case to sort of positive appropriation of globalization discourse, and on the other, the sort of real problems that are being caused by when globalization hits back in a rather nasty way. Finish there.
Right. Chris, thank you very much. That's a very... very thought-provoking set of comments, which raises lots of different issues. I guess the one, well, I have to be back in my critical mode. Actually, I found it very nice, but I'm going to be in my critical mode anyway, and say that, I mean, one thing that seemed to, in a way, permeate your comments, which I think is highly problematic in a lot of the literature on globalization and nationalism, these kinds of themes, is you seem, at least in this presentation, to very much be taking kind of top-down approach, almost as if you're taking it for granted that, you know, globalization is something that really happens at this big mega level of governments and corporations and so on, and that in a way, if people out there, regular ordinary people, are able to do something, it's more or less thanks to the assistance or the permission of governments and so on. But a different approach might say that precisely what's interesting about globalization, if it is interesting, is the extent to which it's driven by little individual agents all over the world who are firing off their emails and undermining authority systems and national boundaries and so on. So in other words, the intriguing thing about globalization, which perhaps really does pose a threat for nationalism, is the story of it seen from the bottom up.
Well, if you're from international relations, I was talking from the bottom up, because
I noticed you said you were going to go down to the level of policy
making. We usually talk about
further down.
Been talking about the global political system for a long time, and so yeah, I mean, I'm treating nationalism as an ideology here and a political movement which is elite led. I think that is fair, looking at Chinese history, modern history, that, you know, there has been this. As other speakers have pointed out, this elite-led political movement, which is an extremely important factor in Chinese political change and behavior. So yes, I left the other stuff to the anthropologists, but I think it is interesting to bring these two together, and I think that's something we should try to do today. you know, how these sort of two approaches do come together, and whether there's sort of there are conflicts between them, or whether they actually support each other. Mm. My sense is, not being an anthropologist, but having used some anthropological literature when looking at globalization, that there have been very useful concepts in anthropology developed by people whose names, Roland Robertson, is it, people like that? We talk about glocalization, the indigenization of things. And I think, you know, that's more or less the same sort of process I'm talking about here, that there is a discourse of globalization, and it has to be appropriated and indigenized by political actors inside China. And the way they do it is to make it highly nationalistic and serve nationalistic purposes. So that's as far as my anthropological sort of methodological expertise goes, but I think it is a very useful insight to those who do look too much from the top down and see it only as a process of homogenization of the world, that it is more sophisticated. And I hope that this sort of builds something of that in the sense of how globalization is appropriated.
Right, thanks very much, Chris. So I guess if we say we'd like to look at this problem both top down and bottom up, the other thing obviously we need to do is look, as I've already said, look at it historically. We need to be able to go back. And that brings us to our last presenter today, Dr. Kent Dung. And I have to apologize because due entirely to my error, Kent Dung's name has not shown up on any single item of publicity for this event today. But in fact, he's playing an incredibly important role because, of course, without the historical perspective on China in globalization, it's all a bit absurd. Anyway, so Kent is also from the LSE. He's a reader in economic history, and his research focuses on a range of really important and interesting topics, primarily in relation to China's pre-modern economy, including the role of the literati in the economic life of pre-modern China, the Chinese maritime economy, fascinating subject, railway development in China, and also the economic role of the Chinese peasantry. So really important range of topics. Kent.
Oh, thanks, Charles. When I was invited, I didn't realize this is a formal occasion, so I'm sort of apologizing to the under sort of addressed. And certainly the topic is, for the historians, it's not new. So I would debate that globalization happened before, it's happening now, but actually the early reincarnation of the globalization in the world, during which the Chinese or China played a crucial role. Instead of being a follower, it was part of the engine of globalization. So now the evidence from our point of view is here. This is the map from Zhenghe's lasting voyages to Southeast Asia, South Asia, and East Africa. That's as accurate as we can get from actually the Chinese documents. Now, this was not the beginning of the globalization. This is China, this is India, this is Africa, Southeast Asia. And these are the sea routes the Chinese actually actively used during this period. So there's a China-dominant trading world during this period up to mid 15th century AD. Now, actually, historians talk about a world system. They have a pre-modern world history. A world system which China was the center, and then you have a modern world system, then China's importance start to decline. Now, for our purpose today, what I'm going to say is the following. Now, when Dagama make this heroic voyage across the Atlantic and then the Indian Ocean to reach Asia, that was the beginning of the first round of globalization. And during this period, China was the engine of that process. The reason is very simple. China had something to offer for the rest of the world. And China, during this period, between 1550 to about 1750, 200 years, China was the single most important silver importer in the world, about a third of total output of silver ended there in China. Now, the Europeans took this advantage to trade with China, not because of they have nothing to offer. It is because this is where the profit can be made. From our records, the Dutch and the English, for example, can easily get 100% profit margin, net profit margin, by trading with China. The reason behind this is through this arbitrage of silver, you can get, the price in of silver in China was twice as high as in Europe and in other parts of the world. So there's a huge demand from the Chinese market for the finished product of silver to facilitate Chinese commercialization at home, because China was poor in resources like gold and silver. These things will have to be imported. So for 200 years, the silver market and the profit made by silver trade supported the formation of the global system, which the Europeans spearhead and also took the lead. Now, in return, the Europeans got porcelain wares, silk, tea. You look around, the typical British household will have a cabinet for silver, for porcelain wares. So that was the influence by the Chinese or by the trade of that round. Also, the trade changed the drinking habit of the British. So you drink tea instead of, increasingly you have more coffee, but for a long time, tea was the preferred drink. And so I would say that this globalization had its first round and a second round, so it is a recurring event at the moment. Of course, the technology is different, the structure, economic structure is different, but the importance of trade, the importance of profit, the importance of exchange of goods and services remain the same. So that's the first point. The second point is China was not outsider. China was actually very much in the center of the first round of globalization. China was the engine, because scholars argue that without the Chinese as the important trading partner, there's no chance for a global trading network to be sustained for such a long time, let alone grow as it did. So this is the beginning of our first round of a pre-modern globalization. Now, the next issue is globalization good for China or bad for China, which is a very touchy topic for us. Now, eventually, the large margin of silver trade gradually disappeared because we know...
Push it up a bit more.
Yeah. Once you have this invisible hand, demand and supply will work its own way, and then you will have to reach an equilibrium. Then the arbitrage and extra profit will disappear over time. That's exactly what happened. Now, for the Chinese, in the beginning, China was capable of play the role as the single most important supplier of things like tea, silk, and the porcelain. But increasingly, China faced this competition from Japan, for example, from Italy, from France, as silk producers start to set up their own business and start to grow, and also porcelain. The British decide to produce their own and they actually beat the Chinese in both quantity and quality. And also tea, the Indians start to grow tea in large quantities. Therefore, as a result, the terms of trade declined. So this is from the book published. This is the chapter I did. This book just published 2 weeks ago. It's pretty very new. And you can see the general trend of the terms of trade declined over time after 1867 to the end of the 19th century. This precisely is what should happen if you allow the market to work its own way globally. Right. So that is, if you demolish things like a tariff, very tough tariff protection, the terms of trade with competition and the multiple supplier will deteriorate. Now, it doesn't mean then the Chinese stop producing. You can see, given this declined terms of trade, China's export of tea and silk rocketed. Right. So actually, from the global point of view, the global market start to get more and cheaper Chinese produce, right, in return. So the Chinese made reasonable returns. If you still you can put these two transparencies together. If I keep this moving, you can see roughly. Given the declining terms of trade, China will be able to make some decent returns still because the sheer quantities of export of tea and the silk. So it has been pretty good for the Chinese tea producers and the silk producers up to the term of the 20th century. Now, also, there's a sort of a standard argument saying globalization was bad because, for example, China started to lose its control of its own national sovereignty, and
Its own national
sovereignty, and the control of its own destiny, and the most touching sort of issue is the who should run the Chinese customs. Surely enough, we know the customs officers were basically, if you like, commissioned to the British. But that's only the part of the picture. If you look at the actually distribution of the revenue collected by the customs officers, you realize the income, the revenue, benefit Chinese more. It's not the case that all the revenue collected by the Chinese or by the British on behalf of the Chinese Empire start to drain away like a capital flight to overseas. No, they mainly use domestically to facilitate Chinese own needs, especially its own program of modernization. So in such a twist, globalization put China in a difficult condition, and this forced China to become modernized. And if we can ignore a little bit of this facade of foreign control and foreign interest, the real money goes to the Chinese pockets. So even during, after, for example, 1900 Boxer Rebellion, when the foreign powers decide to interfere with the Chinese internal politics, and China was forced to drop protections of its local domestic market. Still, China was to some extent the beneficiary of this process. Now, with this, modern industry start to grow, and this is only some evidence of the locations and the sizes of modern factories, industries in China during this period. So indeed, the first round of globalization before World War I actually generated a new type of economy within the empire, which is the modern economy, characterized with Western technology. Certainly Western technicians were hired, foreign technology capital were used. So this is another example, railways. In the beginning, and this is completely alien, the Chinese never had anything remotely sort of similar to railways in its own, if you like, stock of technology. Now, you have several lines. That's in the beginning of the story when the Europeans were allowed to build railways in China. This is the still running, actually, the railways are still running today. So in the sense, the Chinese are still benefiting from this new technology and the economy. Now, not only 2 decades later, you can see railways boomed in China. And this is a untold story in terms of globalization. You can, if I keep this moving, you can probably see how wonderful this is. So,
a few more minutes.
I'm told to.
What is the date of the second slide?
The second is 1930, before the Japanese invasion. So, I think I have to shut up.
No. Sorry, that wasn't quite as abrupt as that. You're allowed to say two more sentences.
Two more sentences. All right. Well, if we put all the costs and the benefits together and actually compare these two, I think on the whole, China gained more. Thanks,
Kent. That's very interesting. I don't have a good critical question, but I have an empirical question, which is that, so your conclusion is that it's good, and I guess my question really is exactly who in China is it good for? That is, I presume that traders and elites did well out of this, but did it really help the mass of the Chinese people? And I partly ask this question because clearly this is very relevant to globalization debates today. We want to know, okay, there's an impact, but how broadly is that distributed? And in particular, at the moment in China, one of the key questions is, did the people away from the coast benefit from what's going on? So, Ken.
Historically, yes. Certainly, the distribution of the wealth and also development in terms of geographic locations are different. But certainly, you expect a country to have some of the leading cities and the regions to pull the economy towards a new direction. So a egalitarian situation won't help much, given the scarcity of technology, the scarcity of capital, scarcity of resources. Certainly, from a pure economics point of view, you will have some cities and centers which will become the leading centers to transform the economy in that new direction. So whether this new type of development and the newly generated income can be trickled down to ordinary people is another matter. It's quite a different matter. We know even in Western Europe, in the early days, the chartered merchants will be far more affluent than the ordinary members of aristocracy. Therefore, it is the same pattern. So we should allow, like the Deng Xiaoping's ideas, fewer people to become rich first.
Okay. Right, we leave the answer to Deng Xiaoping in this case. That's good. because I'm very conscious of the time, and I know that people have other things they need to go to, what I'd like to do just quickly, if I can, is give each of our speakers a chance to ask a question of another speaker, and I'm afraid that's really all that we're going to have time for. Too many subjects today. Perhaps we could start with Chris, if that's all right. You can free mic.
That's fine, and to get a healthy debate going, I'd like to challenge all the speakers, all the other speakers, because it seems to me that the idea of globalization that's being that's implicit in all these presentations, apart from mine, it is so big that it becomes almost useless. If it means just appropriating and indigenizing Western culture, this is nothing new. We know that this went on in the Tang Dynasty with the impact of Buddhism and so on. Equally, these economic transactions have been taking place, and there were a lot of them in the 19th century, and then they died out in the early 20th, and now they've been revived. But surely we need a much more specific idea of globalization here, a narrower one, to be useful, analytically useful. And I would suggest it is one that is marked by events since the early 1980s, the deregulation of financial markets, the information technology revolution, the end of the Cold War, and then the promotion of a globalist ideology, certainly by the Clinton-Gore administration, also perhaps a bit by the Elder Bush administration before that, and that all this adds up to a very different kind of politics and world situation in some way, which is different qualitatively and quantitatively from what came before. And that if you look at it in that way, some of the things people have said can be challenged. For example, one speaker implied that globalization has been good for opening up China. Well, is that chronologically correct? Because actually the reform and opening policies began before all these big events happened. And so it was something that came, maybe it was triggered by the Nixon-Mao rapprochement, you know, and the invasion of Afghanistan by the Soviet Union. These are the factors that explain reform and opening, and that we cannot then just present all these as globalization. We need a specific, narrow political definition.
You didn't name him, but you mean James Watson. let's ask James Watson. If globalization means everything, is it too broad a term? It's not useful and misleading.
I agree that we have talked a lot on this panel, and we've used the term globalization to cover many issues that, as I said in my opening statement, that a lot has to do with the idea that as representatives of various disciplines, we're like the proverbial blind people grasping hold of the elephant, and I prefer at this point in my life to grab a hold of the shiny tusks rather than the smelly tail. And therefore, in that respect, my view of globalization is a bit more optimistic than my colleagues, partly because I drew the short stick. Charles, I think, in a way, kind of assigned me to talk about the positive side. And also, pessimism is an indulgence of youth. And you'll note that everyone on the panel is younger than me. But if you look at globalization of popular culture, which is what I work on in my own field research, you can begin to date the actual point of various cultural influences, various cultural systems that can be very nicely prescribed historically. And for instance, if you look at the introduction of Western films, cinema, you can look at even at the actual inaugurations, such as the films. There was the films that come out of Washington that have had huge effects on popular culture and imagination. There's the Fugitive, which some of you may have seen. It's an American potboiler with Tommy Lee Jones and Harrison Ford. It's basically chase scenes in China. It was a routine film in most parts of the world, but it absolutely caused an explosion of interest in China when it was released in the mid-1990s. Prior to this time, Western films were very limited. One film that was shown time immemorial in China, of course, was Spartacus, because it had a good class message. but the introduction of Western films, I think, you can track them through many societies, even in Indian society, where the challenge to the Bollywood films were introduced about the same time when the state began to open up in that regard. So I think it's very important to be very clear about which domains of popular culture that we're looking at. And I also, as an anthropologist, would resist the kind of hegemony of econometric theory that would argue that we have to look first to economic measures to understand globalization, and that everything else is a derivative of the sorts of things that have been mentioned. In other words, the negotiations with the World Bank and others. To me, those are epiphenomena. What's critical is how people live their ordinary lives.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yunxiang, you have a question for someone or all of them.
Well, since you named me, I have to do something.
Yes.
Well, I guess I wonder whether it is purely by accident that Charles sit in the middle and separate us in this way, and anthropologists sitting on this side and
others.
So I will just follow the hint and ask questions ask questions for, I say, addressing question to both Dr. Hughes and Dr. Deng, one for each. For Dr. Hughes, I really appreciate your analysis of the link between nationalism and the discussion about globalization, and you quite correctly point out that a lot of talk about globalization actually is hijacked by discussion of nationalism. But however, I still want to know more how these two linked. And in addition to the numbers you searched from the articles, for instance, I can give you a more specific clue. From our anthropological point of view, I think it is very interesting to look at, again, the Chinese discourse of globalization. What are they talking about? The majority of them actually are talking about modernization. They reinterpreted globalization as the last stage of modernization, also the last chance for China to catch the boat. So this idea has been shared by both government leaders and intellectual elites. So in that sense, they work together to promote a kind of a new interpretation of globalization. And in the West, in most cases, globalization has been regarded as a postmodern condition. Yet in China, it's being reinterpreted as a pre-modern condition. If that being accepted, then who can lead China march into the postmodern stage? Mm. The answer is clear. Mm. So that's just one way of approaching the link between the two. I wonder whether, from a political science point of view, you have other more specific things to talk about the link. I'm very much interested in that.
Why don't we let Chris respond to that, yeah? You have another question. Yeah?
No, another question is for Dr. Deng.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, thanks. I mean, yes, I really what I wanted to say was, if you look at the figures, you know, this search I did, obviously it's an interesting exercise, but the figures themselves don't prove anything. You have to look at the content of what's being written. And when you do, I haven't read all those articles, I must say.
5,000.
I've read a few, yeah.
You can.
And I think more or less, when you correlate it with political developments in China and the party line and developments of that, you can see the dynamics or the certain rules of the discourse, I suppose you'd say, if you're into discourse analysis, how they emerge. And and I think also this is why we need a sort of narrower definition. You know, what are the influences in here? Well, of course, there are those influences from the Ti Yong debates in the Neo-Confucians of the 19th century, Chen Duxiu, you know, people like that. But also, you know, there's Al Gore, there's Alvin Toffler, the third wave, there's Samuel Huntington. You know, these are the people that have to be dealt with in some way. And you can see this quite clearly in the text, that people aren't saying these people are sort of, you know, bourgeois, you know, imperialists or something at all. They're saying these people are wonderful. Mm. You know, let's use them and harness them behind the sort of nation-building project. And I think the content of all this, and a lot of it is, I suppose, you know, the permission comes from Jiang Zemin, in a sense, in the way that he opens up that discourse by putting globalization in the party line, although he's, you know, that's oversimplifying it, of course. But that dynamic is there, I think, and you can see that quite clearly from the contents of the text. There is actually an article on this coming out in Journal of Contemporary China, but probably early next year.
I think maybe we should give Kent a chance to ask a question. Maybe we'll be able to come back to it. Kent, would you please?
Should I ask a question?
Ask a question,
right.
Please.
I'm quite intrigued by the approach of anthropology, and I wonder, in your profession, why you decide to choose Heilongjiang, for example, instead of Beijing and Shanghai, and how representative they are, your case, for the whole lot of China. The wolf and the sheep analogy is an interesting one. Is it because the Heilongjiang people are so tough, or is it because so I sort of wonder whether how representative they are, these cases are, for to interpret the pulse of globalization in China.
Well, that's a challenge one. I guess I can't answer. Well, actually, I think in anthropology, we're not concerned that much about how a representative a particular community is, because we are more interested in the diversified ways by which people can adapt to a certain particular environment and construct a particular kind of a culture. So, in other words, our study tends to enrich rather than reduce this understanding of a culture and a society to a certain pattern. Instead, we enrich, providing more and more different angles. That's how I understood. And my mentor may say something different and criticize me, saying, totally wrong, and we are wasting my time. You wasted my time. But that's how I understand. So in terms of my choice of Heilongjiang, it's just because I know the people very well. And so I never meant to use the village as the representative of China in a literal sense, but they're representing China in a certain sense. That's it. It's very limited.
So I gather they have a taste of a McDonald's.
No, not at all.
So they're not that modern yet?
No.
All right.
Okay, I think we've really just got time for one last question. Woody, do you want to ask something, or do you not want to ask it?
Maybe somebody in the audience. I'll defer my question to the audience right now.
Yeah, it's very embarrassing, because really what we would have liked to have done is to have lots of questions from the audience, but we've kind of used up our time. It's quite difficult. But could I ask someone to ask us a question from the audience? Sorry, we're sort of down here looking at you. Yeah, could you stand up so people will hear? Here's a mic.
For Woody, who named the critical language in an American perspective, is there a possibility that a critical sport like baseball could be come over to China?
A sport like baseball.
Can there be baseball in China?
Well, there's baseball in Taiwan. Extremely good baseball, because they always win the Little League World Series, usually about 9 out of 10 years and running. So, of course, it could. But no, I think basketball is much more of a global sport. And I have a theory about that. Anybody can play basketball. All you need is a ball and a hoop, and you don't need a lot of resources. Anybody can do it. It's logical in that respect. In other words, in some respects, I have colleagues at Harvard that argue that cricket is the true global form, but I would argue that basketball is fast replacing it. And it's, I would argue, primarily because of Michael Jordan and the vision of the flying slam dunk that, of course, is now being replaced by Yao Ming and his amazing dexterity and such for such a large person. So things are happening. But sports is a very interesting and revealing way to look at globalization. And I think that's something that has to be taken seriously by people who are interested in the economic and political consequences of these systems that we're describing.
I mean, I think I might just say at that point that, you know, obviously one of the tensions between different ways of approaching these questions is to do between, it's a tension between very micro kinds of approaches and macro approaches. I think sometimes the micro approaches, you know, we're going to talk about is, will there be baseball, you know, how do people like McDonald's and so on. There's a danger that when you just hear a little bit about this kind of research, it can actually seem a little bit trivial. I mean, it's interesting, but, you know, does it really tell you anything important? I think at first glance, we can often think that it perhaps doesn't. But of course, you have to give certainly these people the benefit of the doubt and look at their actual research and the actual things they publish as opposed to what they say in a panel like this. And for example, if I can say, certainly for Professor Watson and other people who've worked with him at Harvard, you know, the issue about McDonald's, for example, is not interesting just like that because McDonald's is interesting, right? It's partly interesting because in China, as elsewhere around the world, food, right, is an incredibly crucial element in not just cultural life, but also political life, economic life, every other kind of life, right? I mean, this isn't unique to China, although Chinese people think it is, but in fact, it's a very common thing around the world that food is an incredibly important thing, partly because, of course, most people around the world for most of history have spent all their time trying to get hold of the food to eat. So what at first glance may seem to be a rather kind of slightly off-the-wall, sexy kind of topic that may not be serious, actually can be serious and important to think about in a deep kind of way. Anyway, on that profound note, I think we better bring it to an end. Thank you very much for coming today, and thanks again to all our presenters.